dinner plate, a backstaff, and a dozen 10-inch ship-spikes. She looked up. Never have I found so much so quickly. And then there's this. She picked up a gold coin and handed it to Hatch. I do not care how rich you are. You do not lose a doubloon like this. Hatch hefted the coin. It was a massive Spanish doubloon, cold and wonderfully heavy. The gold gleamed as brilliantly as if the coin had been minted a week ago, the heavy cross of Jerusalem stamped off-center, embracing the lion and castle that symbolized Leon and Castile. The inscription, Philippus IV, Dei Grat, ran around the rim. The gold warmed in his palm as his heart quickened despite himself. Now here is another mystery, said Bonterre. In the 17th century, sailors never buried people with their clothes on. Because on board ship, to say, clothes were extremely valuable. But if you did bury them clothed, you would at least search them, no? That packet of gold in the boot was worth a fortune to anyone, even a pirate. And then, why did they leave all these other things behind? Pistols, cutlasses, cannon, spikes. These were the heart's blood of a pirate. And a backstaff, the very means of finding your way home. None would leave such things behind willingly. At that moment, St. John appeared. Some more bones are appearing, Isabel, he said, touching her elbow lightly. More? In a different grid? Christoph, how exciting! Hatch followed them back to the site. The workers had cleared the second grid down to bone and were now feverishly working on a third. As Hatch looked down at the new excavation, his excitement gave way to unease. Three more skulls were exposed in the second grid, along with a careless riot of other bones. Turning, he watched the workers in the third grid brush the damp dirt away with bristled brushes. He saw the cranium of one skull appear, and then another. They continued to work, the virgin soil yielding up brown. A long bone, then the talus and calcaneus of a heel, pointing skyward as if the corpse had been placed in the earth face down. Teeth gripping the ground soil, Hatch murmured. What? St. John started. Nothing. A line from the Iliad. No one buried their dead face down. At least not respectfully. A mass grave, Hatch thought. The bodies thrown in willy-nilly. It reminded him of something he had once been called to examine in Central America, peasant victims of a military death squad. Even Bonterre had fallen silent, her high spirits fading fast. What could have happened here? She asked, looking around. I don't know, Hatch said, a strange, cold feeling in the pit of his stomach. There do not appear to be signs of violence on the bones. Violence sometimes leaves only subtle traces, Hatch replied. Or they might have died of disease or starvation. A forensic examination would help. He looked back over the grisly sight. Masses of brown bones were now coming to light, the skeletons stacked three deep in places, sprawled across each other, their tattered bits of rotten leather darkening in the light rain. Could you do such an examination? Bonterre asked. Hatch stood at the edge of the grave, not answering for a moment. It was nearing the close of day and the light was fading. In the rain, mist, and growing twilight, against the mournful sound of the distant surf, everything seemed to turn gray and lifeless, as if the vitality itself was being sucked out of the landscape. Yes, he said after a moment. There was another long silence. What could have happened here? Bonterre repeated to herself in a whisper. Chapter 26. At dawn the next morning, the senior crew gathered in the pilot house of the Griffin. The atmosphere was far different than the subdued, demoralized atmosphere Hatch remembered after Ken Field's accident. Today there was electricity in the air, a kind of pregnant expectation, At one end of the table, Bonterre was talking to Streeter about transporting the excavation findings to the storage facility, while the team leader listened silently. At the other end, a remarkably disheveled and unkempt-looking Wapner was whispering animatedly to St. John, punctuating his sentences with wild hand gestures. As usual, Needleman was not to be seen, remaining in his private quarters until all had assembled. Hatch helped himself to a cup of hot coffee and a massive greasy doughnut, then settled into a chair next to Rankin. The door to the cabin opened and Needleman emerged. As he came up the steps, Hatch could tell instantly that the captain's mood matched that of the rest of the pilot house. He motioned Hatch to the door of the cabin. "I want you to have this, Mallon," he said in a low tone, pressing something heavy into Hatch's hand. With surprise, Hatch recognized the massive gold doubloon Bonterre had uncovered the day before. He looked at the captain, mutely questioning. "It's not much," Needleman said with a slight smile. "The smallest fraction of your eventual share. But it's the first fruit of our labors. I wanted you to have it as a token of our thanks for making such a difficult choice." Hatch mumbled his thanks as he slipped the coin into his pocket, feeling unaccountably awkward as he walked back up the steps and took a seat at the table. Somehow he felt an aversion to taking the doubloon off the island, as if it would be bad luck to do so before the rest of the treasure had been found. "Am I growing superstitious, too?" he wondered half-seriously, making a mental note to lock the coin up in the medical hut. Needleman strode to the head of the table and contemplated his crew, emanating a remarkable nervous energy. Needleman looked impeccable, showered, shaved, dressed in pressed khakis, the skin tight and clean across his bones. His gray eyes looked almost white in the warm light of the cabin. "I believe there's a lot to report this morning," he said, glancing around the table. "Dr. Magnuson, let's start with you."
"The pumps are primed and ready, Captain," the engineer replied. "We've set up additional sensors in some secondary shafts, as well as inside the cofferdam to monitor water depth during draining." Needleman nodded, his sharp, eager eyes moving down the table.
"Mr. Streeter?"
"The cofferdam's complete. All tests for stability and structural integrity are positive. The grappling hook's in place, and the excavating team is standing by on the Cerberus awaiting instructions."
"Excellent." Needleman looked toward the historian and the programmer. "Gentlemen, I believe you have news of a rather different nature."
"Indeed we have," St. John began.
"Let me handle this, Chris Baby," Wapner said. "We've cracked the second code." There was an audible intake of breath around the table. Hatch sat forward, his grip on the armrests tightening involuntarily.
"What does it say?"
Bonterre blurted out. Wapner held up his hands.
"I said we'd cracked it. I didn't say we'd deciphered it. We found some repeating letter sequences, we've set up an electronic contact sheet, and we've deciphered enough words that match the first half of the journal to know we're on track."
"That is all?"
Bonterre slumped back in her chair.
"What do you mean, that's all?"
Wapner looked incredulous.
"That's the whole ball of wax.
We know what kind of code it is. A polyalphabetic, using somewhere between 5 and 15 cipher alphabets. Once we know the exact number, it's just a question of letting the computer do its thing. Using probable word analysis, we should know that in a matter of hours."
"A polyalphabetic cipher," Hatch repeated.
"That was Christopher's theory all along, wasn't it?"
This elicited a grateful look from St. John and a dark glare from Wapner. Needleman nodded. "And the programs for the ladder array?"
"I've tested the simulation on the Cerberus computer," Wapner said, flinging back a lock of limp hair. "Smooth as butter. Of course, the thing isn't in the pit yet," he added significantly.
"Very well." Needleman stood and moved to the arc of window, then turned to face the group. "I don't think there's much I need add. Everything is ready. At 1000 hours, we will start the pumps and begin draining the water pit.
Mr. Streeter, I want you to keep a close watch on the cofferdam. Alert us at the first sign of any problem. Keep Nyad and Grampus nearby, just in case. Mr. Wapner, you'll be monitoring the situation from Island 1, running final tests on the ladder array. Dr. Magnuson will direct the overall pumping process for Morthank. He stepped toward the table. If all goes according to plan, the pit will be drained by noon tomorrow. The structure will be monitored closely while it stabilizes. During that afternoon, our crews will remove the largest obstructions from the pit and insert the ladder array. And the following morning, we'll make our first descent. His voice dropped, and his eyes moved from person to person. I don't need to remind you that even free of water, the pit will remain a highly dangerous place. In fact, removing the water places a much greater load on its wooden members. Until we've braced it with titanium struts, there could still be cave-ins or collapses. A small team will be inserted to make initial observations and place piezoelectric stress sensors on the critical wooden beams. Once the sensors are in place, Carrie here will calibrate them remotely from Island 1. If there is any sudden increase in stress, signaling a possible collapse, these sensors will give us an early warning. The sensors will be remotely linked with the network via RF, so we'll have instantaneous response. Once they're in place, we can insert teams to begin a formal mapping process. Needleman placed his hands on the table. I've thought carefully about the composition of this first team. But in the end, there's really no question about who has to go. There will be three people. Dr. Bonterre, Dr. Hatch, and myself. Dr. Bonterre's expertise in archaeology, soil analysis, and pirate construction will be vital in this first look at the pit. Dr. Hatch must accompany us in case any unforeseen medical emergencies arise. And as for the third position on the team, I'm claiming captain's privilege. A glint sparkled briefly in his eyes. I know that most, if not all of you, are anxious to see what awaits us. I fully understand. And let me assure you that in the days to come, every one of you will get the chance to become familiar, no doubt all too familiar, with McCallan's creation. He straightened up. Any questions? The pilot house was still. The captain nodded. In that case, let's take care of business. Chapter 27. The following afternoon, Hatch left the island in fine high spirits. The pumps had been chugging in tandem all the previous day and on into the night, sucking millions of gallons of brown seawater out of the pit, piping it across the island, and dumping it back into the ocean. Finally, after 30 hours, the uptake hoses had struck silt at the bottom of the water pit, 140 feet down. Hatch had waited tensely in his medical office, but by 5 he'd received word that high tide had come and gone without any apparent seepage of seawater into the pit. There had been an anxious watch as the massive timbering groaned, creaked, and settled under its heavier burden. Seismographic sensors registered some small cave-ins, but they were in adjoining side tunnels and pits, not the main shaft. After a few hours, the major settling seemed to cease. The cofferdam had held. Now a crew was at work with a magnetized grappling hook, clearing out debris that had fallen into the water pit over the centuries and snagged on various crossbeams and timbers. After mooring his boat in Stormhaven, Hatch stopped by the co-op to pick up a salmon fillet. Then, on impulse, he drove the 8 miles down the coast to Southport. Driving along Route 1A, the old coastal highway, he could see a line of sullen lightning flicker jaggedly across 40 degrees of sea horizon, pale yellow against the blues and pinks of the evening. A massive thunderhead had reared up beyond Monhegan Island far to the south, rising to 30,000 feet, its steel-colored interior glinting with internal electricity. A typical summer storm, promising a heavy rain and perhaps a few bolts, but without the virulence to blow up a dangerous sea. Southport's grocery, though poorly stocked by Cambridge standards,
carried a number of things not found in Bud's superette. As he got out of his Jaguar, Hatch made a quick scan of the street. It wouldn't do for anyone to recognize him and report the treasonous act to Bud. He smiled to himself, thinking how alien this small-town logic would seem to a Bostonian. Arriving home, Hatch made a pot of coffee and poached the salmon with lemon, dill, and asparagus, then whipped up a sauce of curried horseradish mayonnaise. Most of the dining room table was covered with a large green canvas, and he cleared a space at the far end and sat down with his dinner and the Stormhaven Gazette. He was partly pleased and partly disappointed to see that the Ragged Island Dig had been relegated to second page. Pride of place on the front page went to the lobster bake, and the moose that had wandered into the storage lot behind Kai Estenson's hardware store ran amok and been tranquilized by game officials. The article on the Dig mentioned excellent progress, despite a few unanticipated setbacks, and went on to say that the man wounded in the prior week's accident was resting comfortably at home. As Hatch had requested, his own name did not appear. Finishing his dinner, he dumped the dishes in the sink, then returned to the dining room and the large green canvas. Sipping a fresh cup of coffee, he pulled the canvas away, exposing a smaller canvas and, on it, two of the skeletons that had been uncovered the day before. He had chosen what he thought were the most complete and representative specimens from the staggeringly large burial group and brought the remains back to his house, where he could examine them in peace. The bones were clean and hard and stained a light brown by the iron-rich soil of the island. In the dry air of the house, they emitted a faint odor of old earth. Hatch stood back, arms akimbo, and contemplated the skeletons and the pathetic collections of buttons, buckles, and hobnails that had been found with them. One had been wearing a ring, a gold ring set with an inferior cabochon garnet, valuable more for historical reasons than anything else. Hatch picked it up from among the neat array of items. He tried it on his little finger, found that it fit, and left it there, somehow pleased at this connection with the long-dead pirate. Summer twilight lay across the meadow beyond the open windows, and frogs in the mill pond at the bottom of the fields had begun their evening vespers. Hatch pulled out a small notebook, writing Pirate A on the left side of a page and Pirate B on the right. Then he scratched these out, replacing them with Blackbeard and Captain Kidd. Somehow, it made them more human. Underneath each heading, he began jotting his first impressions. First, Hatch sexed the skeletons carefully. He knew there were more female pirates plying the seas in the 1700s than most people realized. Both were male. They were also nearly toothless, a characteristic shared with the other skeletons in the mass grave. Hatch picked up a loose mandible, examining it with a magnifying glass. Along the mandibular process, there was scarring due to lesions of the gums, and places where the bone had been thinned and apparently eaten away. The few remaining teeth showed a striking pathology, a separation of the odontoblast layer from the dentin. Hatch laid the jawbone down, wondering whether this was due to disease, starvation, or simply poor hygiene. He cradled the skull of the pirate he'd labeled Blackbeard and examined it Yorick style. Blackbeard's one remaining upper incisor was distinctly shoveled. That implied either East Asian or Amerindian stock. He replaced the skull and continued his examination. The other pirate, Kidd, had broken his leg in the past. The ends of the bone around the fracture were abraded and calcified, and the break had not knitted together well. Probably walked around with a limp and in severe pain. In life, Kidd would not have been a good-tempered pirate. The man also had an old wound in the clavicle. There was a deep score in the bone, surrounded by spurs. Cutlass blow, Hatch wondered. Both men appeared to be under 40. If Blackbeard was Asiatic, Captain Kidd was probably Caucasian. Hatch made a mental note to ask St. John if he knew anything about the racial makeup of Occam's crew. Hatch walked around the table, musing, then picked up a femur. It seemed light and insubstantial. He bent it and, to his surprise, felt it snap like a dry twig between his fingers. He peered at the ends. clearly a case of osteoporosis, thinning of the bone, rather than simple graveyard decay. Looking more closely now, he examined the bones of the other skeleton and found the same symptoms. The pirates were too young for this to be gerontological in origin. Again, it could be either poor diet or disease. But what disease? He ran through the symptoms of several possibilities, his diagnostic mind working, and then suddenly broke into a broad smile. He turned to his working bookshelf and plucked off the well-thumbed copy of Harrison's Principles of Internal Medicine. He flipped through the index until he found what he was looking for, then turned quickly to the page. Scurvy, it read. Scorbutus, vitamin C deficiency. Yes, there were the symptoms. Loss of teeth, osteoporosis, cessation of the healing process, even the reopening of old wounds. He shut the book and slipped it back on the shelf. Mystery solved. Hatch knew that scurvy was now rare in most of the world. Even the poorest third-world areas he had practiced in produced fresh fruits and vegetables, and in all his career he had never seen a case. Until now. He stepped back from the table, feeling uncommonly pleased with himself. The doorbell rang. Damn, he thought, hastily pulling the canvas cover over the skeletons before stepping into the living room. One of the prices of living in a small town was that nobody thought to telephone before dropping by. It wouldn't do, he thought, to be seen with his dining room table laid with ancient skeletons instead of the family silver. Stepping up to the front and glancing out the window, Hatch was surprised to see the stooped form of Professor Orville Horn. The old man was leaning on his cane, wisps of white hair standing from his head as if charged up with a Van de Graaff generator.
"Ah, the abominable Dr. Hatch," the professor said as the door opened. "I was just passing by and saw the lights burning in this old mausoleum of yours."
His small bright eyes roved restlessly as he spoke.
"I thought perhaps you'd been down in the dungeons, cutting up bodies. Some young girls are missing from the village, you know, and the townsfolk are restless."
His gaze landed on the large canvas lump on the dining room table.
"Hello? What's this?"
"Pirate skeletons," said Hatch with a grin.
"You wanted a present, right?
Well, happy birthday." The professor's eyes went incandescent with delight as he stepped unbidden into the living room.
"Marvelous," he cried. "My suspicions were well-founded, I see. Where did you get them?"
The lass's archaeologist uncovered the site of the pirate encampment on Ragged Island a couple of days ago, Hatch replied, leading the old man into the dining room. "They found a mass grave. I thought I'd bring a couple back and try to determine cause of death." The professor's shaggy brows raised at this information. Hatch pulled back the canvas cover and his guest leaned forward with interest, peering closely, poking an occasional bone with his cane.
"I believe I've figured out what killed them," said Hatch.
The professor held up his hand.
"Hush. Let me try my hand."
Hatch smiled, remembering the professor's love of scientific challenges. It was a game they had played on many an afternoon, the professor giving Hatch a bizarre specimen or scientific conundrum to puzzle over. Dr. Horn picked up Blackbeard's skull, turned it over, looking at the teeth.
"East Asian," he said, putting it down.
"Very good."
"Not terribly surprising," replied the professor. "Pirates were the first equal opportunity employers. I imagine this one was Burmese or Bornean. Might have been a Lascar."
"I'm impressed," Hatch said.
"How soon they forget."
The professor moved around the skeletons, his beady eyes glittering like a cat circling a mouse. He picked up the bone Hatch had broken.
"Osteoporosis," he said, raising an eye in Hatch's direction.
Hatch smiled and said nothing. Dr. Horn picked up a mandible.
"Evidently these pirates did not believe in flossing twice a day."
He examined the teeth, stroked his face with a long, thoughtful finger, and straightened up.
All indications point to scurvy. Hatch could feel his face fall. You figured that out a lot faster than I did. Scurvy was endemic on sailing ships in past centuries. Common knowledge, I'm afraid. Maybe it was rather obvious, said Hatch, a little crestfallen. The professor gave him a pointed look, but said nothing.
Come on, have a seat in the parlor, Hatch said. Let me get you a cup of coffee.
When he returned with a tray of cups and saucers a few minutes later, the professor had taken a seat in an easy chair and was idly flipping through one of the old mysteries Hatch's mother had so adored. She'd kept about 30 on the shelf. Just enough, she'd said, so that by the time she'd finished the last, she would have forgotten the first and could start over again. Seeing this man out of his own childhood, sitting in his front parlor and reading his mother's book, gave Hatch a sudden stab of bittersweet nostalgia, so intense that he banged the tray harder than he intended onto the small table. The professor accepted a cup, and they sat for a moment, drinking in silence.
Manon, the old man said, clearing his throat. I owe you an apology.
Please, Hatch replied. Don't even mention it. I appreciated your candor.
To hell with my candor.
I spoke hastily the other day.
I still think Stormhaven would be better off without that goddamn treasure island, but that's neither here nor there. I have no right to judge your motives. You do what you have to do.
Thanks.
As atonement, I've brought along a little something for show and tell this evening, he said, the old familiar gleam in his eye.
He removed a box from his pocket and opened it to reveal a strange, double-lobed shell, a complicated pattern of dots and striations set into its surface.
What is it? You've got 5 minutes.
Siamese sea urchin, Hatch said, handing the shell back. Nice specimen, too.
Damn. Well, if you refuse to be stumped, at least make yourself useful by explaining the circumstances surrounding that.
The professor jerked a thumb in the direction of the dining room.
I want all details, no matter how trivial. Any oversights will be dealt with most harshly.
Stretching out his legs and crossing his feet on the braided carpet, Hatch related how Bonterre found the encampment, the initial excavations, the discovery of the mass grave, the gold, the astonishing array of artifacts, the dense tangle of bodies. The professor listened, nodding vigorously, eyebrows alternately rising and falling at each fresh piece of information.
What surprises me most, Hatch concluded, is the sheer body count. The teams had identified 80 individuals by the end of this afternoon, and the site isn't fully excavated yet.
Indeed. The professor fell into silence, his gaze resting vaguely in the middle distance. Then he roused himself, put down his cup, brushed the lapels of his jacket with a curiously delicate gesture, and stood up.
Scurvy, he repeated, almost to himself, and followed with a snort of derision. Walk me to the door, will you? I've taken up enough of your time for one evening.
At the door, the professor paused and turned. He gave Hatch a steady look, his eyes dancing with veiled interest.
Tell me, Malin, what are the dominant flora of Ragged Island? I've never been there.
Well, said Hatch, it's a typical outer island. No trees to speak of, covered with sawgrass, chokecherries, burdock, and tea roses.
Ah, chokecherry pie. Delicious. And have you ever experienced the pleasure of rosehip tea?
Of course, said Malin. My mother drank lots of rosehip tea. For her health, she said. Hated the stuff myself. Professor Horn coughed into his hand, a gesture that Hatch remembered as one of disapproval. What? He asked defensively.
Chokecherries and rosehips, the professor said.
were a staple part of the diet along this coast in centuries past. Both are very good for you. Extremely high in vitamin C. There was a silence.
Oh, said Hatch. I see what you're getting at.
17th century sailors may not have known what caused scurvy, but they did know that almost any fresh berries, fruits, roots, or vegetables cured it. The professor looked searchingly at Hatch. And there's another problem with our hasty diagnosis.
What's that?
It's the way those bodies were buried.
The old man rapped his cane on the floor for emphasis.
Mallon, scurvy doesn't make you toss 40 people into a common grave and skedaddle in such a hurry that you leave gold and emeralds behind.
There was a distant flash, then a roll of thunder far to the south.
But what would? Hatch asked.
Dr. Horn's only answer was an affectionate pat on the shoulder. Then he turned, limped down the steps, and hobbled away, the faint tapping of his cane sounding long after his form had disappeared into the warm, enveloping darkness of Ocean Lane. Chapter 28 Early the next morning, Hatch entered Island 1 to find the small command and control center jammed with an unusually large gathering. Bonterre, Carrie Wapner, and St. John were all talking at once. Only Magnuson and Captain Needleman were silent. Magnuson quietly running diagnostics, and Needleman standing in the center, lighting his pipe, calm as the eye of a hurricane.
"Are you nuts or something?"
Wapner was saying.
"I should be back on the Cerberus decrypting that journal, not friggin' spelunking. I'm a programmer, not a sewer worker."
"There's no other choice," Needleman said, taking his pipe from his mouth and looking at Wapner. "You saw the numbers."
"Yeah." What did you expect? Nothing works right on this damn island.
Did I miss something? Hatch said, coming forward.
Ah. Good morning, Mallon, Needleman said, giving him a brief smile.
Nothing major. We've had a few problems with the electronics on the ladder array.
A few,
Wapner scoffed.
The upshot is that we'll have to take Carrie along with us this morning on our exploration of the pit.
"The hell with that,"
Wapner said petulantly.
"I keep telling you, the last domino has fallen. That code is mine, believe you me. Scylla will have the bad boy fully deciphered in a couple of hours."
"If the last domino has fallen, then Christopher here can do the monitoring," Needleman said, a little more sharply.
"That's correct,"
St. John replied, his chest swelling slightly.
"It's just a question of taking the output and making some character substitutions."
Wapner looked from one to the other, his lower lip projecting in an exaggerated pout.
"It's a simple matter of where you're most needed," Needleman said. "And you're most needed on our team."
He turned to Hatch.
"It's imperative that we get these piezoelectric sensors in place throughout the pit. Once they're linked to the computer network, they'll serve as an early warning system in case of structural failure anywhere underground. But so far, Carrie's been unsuccessful at calibrating the sensors remotely from Island 1.
He glanced at Wapner. "With the network acting flaky, that means he's going to have to come along with us and calibrate them manually, using a palm-top computer. Then he can download the information into the computer's registry. It's a nuisance, but there's nothing else for it."
"A nuisance?" Wapner said. "A major pain in the ass is more like it. Most of the crew would give half their shares to be along on the first penetration," St. John said.
"Penetrate this," Wapner muttered as he turned away. Bonterre giggled. Needleman turned to the historian.
"Tell Dr. Hatch about the sentence you just deciphered from the second half of the journal."
St. John cleared his throat self-importantly.
"It's not a sentence, really," he said. "More of a sentence fragment.
Ye who lust after the key to the, some word or other, pit shall find.
Hatch looked at the captain in amazement. So there is a secret key to the water pit. Needleman smiled, rubbing his hands together with anticipation. It's almost 8, he said. Assemble your gear and let's get started. Hatch returned to his office for his medical field kit, then met up with the group as they were trekking up the rise of the island toward Orthanc.
Merde, it's cold,
Bonterre said, blowing on her hands and hugging herself.
What kind of a summer morning do you call this?
A summer morning in Maine, Hatch replied. Enjoy it. The air will put hair on your chest.
That is something I have little need of, Monsieur le Docteur.
She jogged ahead, trying to keep warm, and as Hatch followed, he realized that he too was shivering slightly. Whether from the cold or the anticipation of the coming descent, he wasn't sure. The tattered edge of a front had at last begun to cast a long shadow across the island, swiftly followed by ranks of piling thunderheads. As he reached the crest of the island, Hatch could see the tall form of Orthanc, bundles of multicolored cable streaming from its dark underbelly down into the maw of the water pit. Only it was no longer the water pit. Now it was drained, accessible, its innermost secrets waiting to be plumbed. Hatch shivered again and moved forward. From this vantage point he could see the gray crescent of the cofferdam, tracing an arc into the sea around the southern end of the island. It was a bizarre sight. On the far side of the cofferdam lay the dark blue expanse of ocean, disappearing into the perpetual veiling mist. On the closer side, the stony seabed lay exposed almost obscenely, scattered with pools of stagnant water. Here and there on the dry ocean floor, Hatch could see markers placed in rocky outcroppings. The flood tunnel entrances, tagged for later examination and analysis. On the beach beside the cofferdam there were several piles of rusted junk, waterlogged wood and other debris grappled up from the depths of the pit, cleared for their expedition. Streeter and his crew were standing at the staging area beside the mouth of the pit, pulling up some cables, dropping others. Approaching, Hatch saw what looked like the end of a massive ladder peering over the top of the pit. The side rails of the ladder were made from thick, gleaming tubes of metal, with two sets of rubber-covered rungs in between. Hatch knew it had taken the team much of the night to bolt the sections together and work them down, maneuvering past invisible obstacles and the remaining snarls of junk caught on the bracing timbers that crisscrossed the shaft.
"That's what I call a ladder on steroids," he said, whistling.
"It's more than a ladder," Needleman replied. "It's a ladder array. Those tubular side rails are made from a titanium alloy. It'll serve as the backbone for the pit's support structure. In time, we'll build a radiating web of titanium struts from the array, which will brace the walls and timbers and keep the pit stable while we dig. And we'll attach a platform lift to the ladder, like an elevator." He pointed toward the ladder struts. "Each tube is wired with fiber optic, coax, and electrical cable, and every rung has a kick light. Eventually, every part of the structure will be computer-controlled, from the servos to the monitoring cameras. But so far, friend Wapner has not been entirely successful in bringing the installation under remote control. Hence, his invitation to join us." He tapped the upper works with one foot. "Built to Thalassa specifications at a cost of nearly $200,000. Wapner, overhearing, came over with a grin. "Hey, Captain," he said. "I know where you can pick up some really nice $600 toilet seats, too." Needleman smiled. "Glad to see your mood improving, Mr. Wapner. Let's get geared up." He turned to the group. "Our most important task today is to attach these piezoelectric stress sensors into the cribbing and shoring beams of the pit." He pulled one from his pack and handed it around. It was a small strip of metal with a computer chip in its center, sealed in hard, clear plastic. At each end, sticking out at right angles, was a half-inch tack. "Just tap or press it into the wood. Mr. Wapner will calibrate and register it into his palm-top database." While Needleman talked, a technician approached Hatch and helped him shrug into a harness.
Then the man handed him a helmet and showed him how to use the intercom and halogen headlamp. Next, he was handed a satchel containing a quantity of the piezoelectric sensors. As he arranged his medical kit, Hatch saw Needleman motioning him toward the railing. He stepped forward, and the captain spoke into the mic attached to his helmet. "Magnuson, restore power to the array." As Hatch watched, a string of lights snapped on along the ladder, illuminating a brilliant yellow light the entire ghastly length of the water pit. The triple row of glowing struts descended into the earth like some pathway to hell. For the first time, Hatch could see just what the pit looked like. It was a ragged square, perhaps 10 feet across, cribbed on all four sides with heavy logs, which were notched and mortised into massive vertical beams at each corner. Every 10 feet, the shaft was crisscrossed by four smaller beams that met in the middle of the pit, evidently bracing the sides and preventing them from collapsing inward. Hatch was struck by how over-engineered the pit seemed to be. It was as if McKellen had built it to last a millennium, instead of the few years it would take for Occam to return and retrieve his treasure. Staring down the descending rows of lights, Hatch finally realized in his gut just how deep the pit was. The lights seemed to stretch toward a pinpoint of darkness, so far below that the rails of the ladder almost converged in the murky depths. The pit was alive, rustling with the sounds of ticking, dripping, and creaking, along with indeterminate whispers and moans. A distant rumble of thunder rolled over the island, and a sudden wind pressed down the sawgrass around the pit. Then a hard rain followed, drowning bracken and machine alike. Hatch stood where he was, partly sheltered by the massive bulk of Orthanc. Within a matter of minutes, he thought, they would simply mount the ladder and climb to the bottom. Once again the perverse feeling returned that everything was too easy, until he felt the pit exhale the cold odor of the mudflat. A powerful smell of salt water mingled with suppuration and decay, the outgassing of dead fish and rotting seaweed. A sudden thought rushed into his mind. Somewhere in that warren of tunnels is Johnny's body. It was a discovery he both wanted and dreaded with all his soul. A technician handed Needleman a small gas monitoring meter, and he slipped it around his neck. "Remember, we're not going down for a leisurely stroll," Needleman said, glancing at the team. "The only time you are to be unclipped from the array is when it becomes necessary to place a sensor. We'll set them, calibrate them, and get out quickly. But while we're at it, I want everyone to make as many observations as possible. The condition of the cribbing, the size and number of the tunnels, anything that seems pertinent. The bottom itself is still deep in mud, so we'll be concentrating on the walls and the mouths of the side tunnels." He paused, adjusting his helmet. "Okay. Clip on your lifelines, and let's go." The lifelines were snapped onto their harnesses. Needleman moved among them, double-checking the carabiners and testing each line. "I feel like a friggin' telephone repairman," Wapner complained. Hatch glanced over at the programmer, who, in addition to his satchel of piezoelectric sensors, had two palm-top computers dangling from his belt. "Why, Kerry," said Bonterre teasingly, "for the first time, you look like a man." By now, much of the crew still on the island had gathered behind the staging area. A cheer went up. Hatch looked around at the elated faces. This was the critical moment they, and he, had been waiting for. Bonterre was grinning widely. Even Wapner seemed affected by the growing excitement. He arranged his equipment and tugged on his harness with a self-important air. Needleman took a last look around, waving at the assembled group. Then he stepped to the rim of the staging area, buckled his line to the ladder array, and began to descend. Chapter 29. Hatch was the last to set foot on the ladder. The others were already stretched out for 20 feet below him. The lights on their helmets played through the murk as they descended hand over hand. A sense of vertigo passed over him,
and he looked up, grabbing at the rung. The ladder was rock solid, he knew. Even if he fell, the lifeline would keep him from tumbling far. As they went deeper, a curious hush fell over the team and among the Orthanc crew, monitoring the mission over the live channel. The incessant sounds of the settling pit, the soft creakings and tickings, filled the air like the whispered teeming of invisible sea creatures. Hatch passed the first cluster of terminal hubs, electrical outlets, and cable jacks that had been set into the ladder at 15-foot intervals. "Everyone all right?" came Needleman's low voice over the intercom. Positive responses came back, one by one. "Dr. Magnuson?" Needleman asked.
"Instruments normal," came the voice from inside Orthanc. "All boards are green."
"Dr. Rankin?"
"Scope's inactive, Captain. No sign of any seismic disturbances or magnetic anomalies."
"Mr. Streeter?"
"All systems on the array are nominal," the laconic voice replied.
"Very well," Needleman said. "We'll continue descending to the 50-foot platform, placing sensors as necessary, then stop for a breather. Be careful not to catch your lifelines on any beams. Dr. Bonterre, Dr. Hatch, Mr. Wapner, keep your eyes open. If you see anything strange, I want to know."
"You kidding?"
came Wapner's voice.
"The whole place is strange."
As he followed the group, Hatch felt almost as if he was sinking into a deep pool of brackish water. The air was clammy and cold, redolent of decay. Each exhalation condensed into a cloud of vapor that hung in the supersaturated air, refusing to dissipate. He looked about, the light on his helmet swiveling with his head. They were now in the tidal zone of the pit, where the water had formerly risen and fallen twice a day. He was surprised to see the same bands of life he'd observed countless times among rocks and tidal pools at the sea edge. First barnacles, then seaweed, then mussels and limpets, followed by a band of starfish. Next, sea cucumbers, periwinkles, sea urchins, and anemones. As he continued to descend, he passed strata of coral and seaweed. Hundreds of whelks still clung pitifully to the walls and beams, hoping in vain for a return of the tide. Now and then a whelk would at last lose its grip and fall into the echoing vastness. Though an immense amount of flotsam and jetsam had already been removed from the drained pit, an obstacle course of ancient junk remained. The ladder array had been deftly threaded through rotting beams, tangles of metal, and discarded pieces of drilling apparatus. The team stopped as Needleman tapped a sensor into a small opening on one side of the pit. As they waited for Wapner to calibrate the sensor, Hatch found his spirits beginning to flag in the mephitic atmosphere. He wondered if the rest of the team shared the feeling, or if he was simply laboring under the additional knowledge that somewhere in this cold, dripping labyrinth lay his brother's body.
"Man, it stinks down here," said Wapner, bending over his handheld computer.
"Air readings normal," came the voice of Needleman. "We'll be installing a ventilation system over the next few days." As they descended once again, the original cribbing in the shaft became more clearly defined as thick layers of seaweed gave way to long hanging strings of kelp. A muffled rumble came from above. Thunder. Hatch glanced up and saw the mouth of the pit etched against the sky, the dark bulk of Orthanc rising in a greenish glow. Farther above, lowering clouds had turned the heavens iron gray. A flicker of lightning flashed a momentary, ghastly illumination into the pit. Suddenly, the group below him stopped. Glancing down, Hatch could see Needleman playing his beam into two ragged openings on either side of the shaft, tunnels that led off into darkness. "What do you think?" asked Needleman, tapping in another sensor.
"It is not original," said Bonterre,
bending carefully into the second opening to affix a sensor and take a closer look.
"Look at the cribbing. It is small and ripsawed, not adzed. Perhaps from the Parkhurst expedition of the 1830s, no?"
She straightened, then gazed up at Hatch, the lance of her headlamp illuminating his legs.
"I can see up your dress," she smirked.
"Maybe we should switch places," Hatch replied.
They worked their way down the ladder, placing stress sensors into the beams and cribbing as they went, until they reached the narrow platform at the 50-foot level. In the reflected light of his helmet, Hatch could see the captain's face was pale with excitement. His skin was covered with a sheen of sweat despite the chilly air. There came another flash of lightning and a distant sound of thunder. The rivulets of water seemed to be trickling faster now, and Hatch guessed it must be raining heavily up top. He looked upward, but the opening was now almost completely obscured by the crisscrossing beams they had passed, the drops of water flying down past his lamp. He wondered if the swell had increased, and hoped the cofferdam would hold it. He had a momentary image of the sea bursting through the cofferdam and roaring back into the pit, drowning them instantly.
"I'm freezing," complained Wapner. "Why didn't you warn me to bring an electric blanket? And it stinks even worse than before."
"Slightly elevated levels of methane and carbon dioxide," Needleman said, looking at his monitor. "Nothing to get worried about."
"He is right, though," said Bonterre, adjusting a canteen on her belt. "It is chilly."
48 degrees, said Needleman tersely. "Any other observations?" There was a silence. "Let's continue, then. We're likely to start finding more shafts and side tunnels beyond this point. We'll alternate placing the sensors. Since Mr. Wapner must calibrate each of them manually, he's going to fall behind. We'll wait for him at the 100-foot platform." At this depth, the crisscrossing support beams had accumulated an incredible variety of trash. Old cables, chains, gears, hoses, even rotting leather gloves were tangled in the crossbeams. They began to come across additional openings cut into the cribbed walls, where tunnels branched off or secondary shafts intersected the main pit. Needleman took the first one, placing sensors back 20 feet. Bonterre took the next. Then it was his own turn. Carefully, Hatch played out some line from his harness, stepping back from the ladder into the cross shaft. He felt his foot sink into yielding ooze. The tunnel was narrow and low, stretching off at a sharp upward angle. It had been crudely hacked out of the glacial till, nothing as elegant as the water pit shaft, obviously of a later date. Stooping, he went 20 feet up the tunnel, then fished a piezoelectric sensor from his satchel and drove it into the calcified earth. He returned to the central pit, placing a small fluorescent flag at the mouth of the shaft to alert Wapner. As he stepped back onto the array, Hatch heard a loud, agonizing complaint from a nearby timber, followed by a flurry of creakings that whispered quickly up and down the shaft. He froze, gripping the ladder tightly, holding his breath. "Just the pit settling," came the voice of Needleman. He had already set his sensor and moved farther down the ladder to the next cross-shaft. As he spoke, there came another screech, sharp and strangely human, echoing from a side tunnel.
"What the hell was that?"
Wapner said, behind them now, his voice a little too loud in the confined space. "More of the same," said Needleman. "The protest of old wood." There was another shriek, followed by a low gibbering.
"That's no goddamn wood," said Wapner.
"That sounds alive." Hatch looked up. The programmer had frozen in the act of calibrating one of the sensors. His palm-top computer was held in one outstretched hand, and the index finger of his other was resting on it, looking ridiculously as if he was pointing into his own palm.
"Get that light out of my eyes, will you?" Wapner said. "The faster I can get these suckers calibrated, the faster I can get out of this shithole."
"You just want to get back to the ship before Christophe steals your glory," said Bonterre good-humoredly.
She had emerged from her side shaft and was now descending the ladder. As they approached the 100-foot platform, another sight came into view. Until now, the horizontal tunnels opening into the side of the shaft had been crude and ragged, poorly shored, some partially caved in. But here, they could see a tunnel opening that had obviously been carefully formed. Bonterre shone her light at the square opening.
"This is definitely part of the original pit," she said.
"What's its purpose?" asked Needleman, pulling a sensor out of his satchel. Bonterre leaned into the tunnel.
"I cannot say for sure.
But you can see how McKellen used the natural fissures in the rock for his construction.
Mr. Wapner, Needleman said, glancing up the shaft. There was a brief silence. Then Hatch heard Wapner respond,
Yes.
It was a quiet, unusually subdued voice. Glancing up, he saw the young man leaning on the ladder perhaps 20 feet above him, beside a flag Hatch had placed, calibrating the sensor. Wet hair was plastered down the sides of his face, and the programmer was shivering. Kerry, Hatch asked, are you all right?
I'm fine.
Needleman glanced first at Bonterre, then at Hatch, his eyes strangely eager. It'll take him some time to calibrate all the sensors we've placed so far, he said. Why don't we take a closer look at this side tunnel? The captain stepped across the gap into the shaft, then helped the others across. They found themselves in a long, narrow tunnel, perhaps 5 feet high and 3 feet across, shored with massive timbers similar to those in the water pit itself. Needleman took a small knife from his pocket and stuck it into one of the timbers. Soft for a half inch, and then solid, he said, replacing the knife. Looks safe. They moved forward cautiously, stooping in the low tunnel. Needleman stopped frequently to test the solidity of the beams. The tunnel ran straight ahead for 50 yards. Suddenly, the captain stopped and gave a low whistle. Glancing ahead, Hatch could see a curious stone chamber, perhaps 15 feet in diameter. It appeared to have 8 sides, each side ending in arches that rose to a groined ceiling. In the center of the floor was an iron grating, puffy with rust, covering an unguessably deep hole. They stood in the entrance to this chamber, each breath adding more mist to the gathering miasma. The quality of the air had grown sharply worse, and Hatch found himself becoming slightly lightheaded. Faint noises came from below the central grate, the whisperings of water, perhaps, or the settling of earth. Bonterre was flashing her light along the ceiling.
Mon Dieu, she breathed. A classic example of the English Baroque style. A little crude, perhaps, but unmistakable.
Needleman gazed at the ceiling. Yes, he said. You can actually see the hand of Sir William here. Look at that Tiercerin and Liern work. Remarkable. Remarkable to think it's been here all this time. 100 feet beneath the earth, Hatch said. But what was it for?
If I had to guess, Bonterre said, I would say the room served some kind of hydraulic function, yes.
She blew a long cloud of mist toward the center of the room. They all watched as it glided toward the grate, then was suddenly sucked down into the depths.
We'll figure it out when we've mapped all this, said Needleman. For now, let's set 2 sensors, here and here.
He tapped the sensors into joints between the stones on opposite sides of the room, then rose and glanced at his gas meter. Carbon dioxide levels are getting a little high, he said. I think perhaps we ought to cut this visit short. They returned to the central shaft to find that Wapner had almost caught up with them. There are 2 sensors in a room at the end of this tunnel, Needleman said to him, placing a 2nd flag in the shaft's mouth. Above, Wapner mumbled something unintelligible, his back to them as he worked with his palm-top computer. Hatch found that if he stayed in one place too long, his breath collected into a cloud of fog around his head, making it difficult to see.
Dr. Magnusson, Needleman spoke into his radio. Status, please. Dr. Rankin is getting a few seismic anomalies on the monitors, Captain, but nothing serious. It could well be the weather.
As if in response, a low crump of thunder echoed faintly down the shaft. Understood. Needleman turned to Bonterre and Hatch. Let's get to the bottom and tag the rest of the shafts. Once again they began their descent. As Hatch moved past the 100-foot platform toward the base of the water pit, he found his arms and legs beginning to shake from weariness and cold. Take a look at this, Needleman said, swiveling his light around. Another well-constructed tunnel, directly below the first. No doubt this is part of the original workings as well.
Bonterre placed a sensor into the nearby joist, and they began moving again. Suddenly there was a sharp intake of breath beneath Hatch, and he heard Bonterre mutter a fervent curse. He looked down, and his heart leaped immediately into his mouth. Below him, tangled in a massive snarl of junk, lay a partially skeletonized corpse, draped in chains and rusting iron, the eyeless sockets of its skull flickering crazily in the light of Bonterre's headlamp. Ribbons of clothing hung from its shoulders and hips, and its jaw hung open as if laughing at some hilarious joke. Hatch felt a curious feeling of displacement, a detached sensation, even as part of his brain realized that the skeleton was far too big to be that of his brother. Looking away and trembling violently, he leaned against the ladder, fighting to get his breath and heartbeat under control, concentrating on the rush of air into and out of his lungs.
"Malin,"
came the urgent voice of Bonterre.
"Malin, this skeleton is very old. Comprends? 200 years old at least."
Hatch waited another long moment, breathing until he was sure he could answer.
"I understand," he said.
Slowly he unlocked his arm from the titanium rung. Then, equally slowly, he lowered first one foot, then the other, until he was level with Bonterre and Needleman. The captain played his light over the skeleton, fascinated, oblivious to Hatch's reaction. "Look at the design of this shirt," he said. "Homespun. Raglan seams. A common garment among early 19th-century fishermen. I believe we've found the body of Simon Rudder, the pit's original victim." They stared at the skeleton until a distant rumble of thunder broke the spell. The captain wordlessly aimed his headlamp beneath his feet. Following the beam with his own, Hatch could now make out their final destination. The bottom of the water pit itself. A huge snarl of broken crosspieces, rusting iron, hoses, gears, rods, and all manner of machinery poked up out of a pool of mud and silt perhaps 20 feet beneath them. Directly above the snarl, Hatch could see several large shaftways converge onto the main pit, damp seaweed and kelp dangling like steaming beards from their mouths. Needleman moved his light around the wildly tangled ruin. Then he turned back to Bonterre and Hatch, his slender form haloed in the chill mist of his own breath. "Perhaps 50 feet beneath that wreckage," he said in a low voice, "lies a $2 billion treasure." Though his eyes moved between them restlessly, they appeared to be focusing on something far beyond. Then he began to laugh, a low, soft, curious laugh. 50 feet, he repeated, "and all we have to do now is dig." Suddenly the radio crackled.
"Captain, this is Streeter."
To Hatch, listening in his headpiece, the dry voice had a note of urgency in it.
"We've got a problem here."
"What?" the captain said, his voice hard, the dreamlike quality suddenly gone. There was a pause, then Streeter came on again.
"Captain, we... just a minute, please. We recommend that you abort your mission and return to the surface at once."
"Why?" Needleman asked. "Is there some problem with the equipment?"
"No, nothing like that."
Streeter seemed uncertain how to proceed.
"Let me patch St. John into you. He'll explain."
Needleman flashed a quick, questioning look at Bonterre, who shrugged in return. The clipped tones of the historian came across the radio.
"Captain Needleman, it's Christopher St. John. I'm on the Cerberus. Scylla has just cracked several portions of the journal."
"Excellent," the captain said. "But what's the emergency?"
"It's what McCallan wrote in this second part. Let me read it to you."
As Hatch stood on the ladder array, wading in clammy darkness at the heart of the water pit, the voice of the Englishman reading McCallan's journal seemed to be coming from a different world entirely.
"I have not been easy this same night past. I feel it a certainty that Occam has plans to dispatch me, as he hath so easily dispatched many others,
Once my usefulness in this vile enterprise has come to an end. And so, by dint of the harrowing of my soul in the small hours, I have decided upon a course of action. It is this foul treasure, as much as the pirate Occam, that is evil, and hath caused our misery upon this forsaken island, and the death of so many in its taking. It is the treasure of the devil himself, and as such shall I treat it.
St. John paused, and there was the rustling of a computer printout. You want us to abort the mission over this?
The exasperation of Needleman's voice was plain. Captain, there's more. Here it is. Now that the treasure pit hath been constructed, I know my time draweth to a close. My soul is at rest. Under my direction, the pirate Occam and his band, unbeknownst, have created a permanent tomb for these unholy gains, got by such suffering and grief. This hoard shall not be repossessed by mortal means. It is thus that I have labored, by various stratagems and conceits, to place this treasure in such wise that not Occam, nor any other man, shall ever retrieve it. The pit is unconquerable, invincible. Occam believes that he holds the key, and he shall die for that belief. I tell ye now, ye who decipher these lines, heed my warning. To descend the pit means grave danger to life and limb. To seize the treasure means certain death. Ye who lust after the key to the treasure pit shall find instead the key to the next world, and your carcass shall rot close to the hell where your soul hath gone.
St. John's voice stopped, and the group remained silent. Hatch looked at Needleman. A slight tremor had taken hold of his jaw, and his eyes were narrow.
So you see, St. John began again. It appears the key to the water pit is that there is no key. It must have been McKellen's ultimate revenge against the pirate who kidnapped him, to bury his treasure in such a way that it could never be retrieved. Not by Occam. Not by anyone.
The point is, Streeter's voice broke in, it's not safe for anyone to remain in the pit until we've deciphered the rest of the code and analyzed this further. It sounds like McKellen has some kind of trap in store for anyone who— Nonsense, interrupted Needleman. The danger he's talking about is the booby trap that killed Simon Rudder 200 years ago and flooded the pit. There was another long silence. Hatch looked at Bonterre, then at Needleman. The captain's face remained stony, his lips compressed and set.
Captain?
Streeter's voice came again. St. John doesn't quite read it that way. This is moot, the captain snapped. We're almost done here. Just another couple of sensors to set and calibrate, and then we'll come up.
I think St. John has a point, Hatch said.
We should cut this short, at least until we figure out what McKellen was talking about.
I agree, said Bonterre.
Needleman's glance flitted between them. Absolutely not, he said brusquely. He closed his satchel, then looked upward. Mr. Wapner. The programmer was not on the ladder, and there was no response on the intercom.
He must be down the passage, calibrating the sensors we placed inside the vault,
Bonterre said. Then let's call him back. Christ, he probably switched off his transmitter. The captain began to ascend the ladder, brushing past them as he climbed. The ladder trembled slightly under his weight.
Just a moment, Hatch thought. That isn't right.
The ladder array had never trembled before. Then it came again. A slight shudder, barely perceptible beneath his fingertips and under his instep. He looked questioningly at Bonterre, and in her glance he could see that she felt it too. Dr. Magnuson, report, Needleman spoke sharply. What's going on?
All normal, Captain.
Rankin? Needleman asked into his radio.
The scopes show a seismic event, but its threshold way below the danger level. Is there a problem?
We're feeling a... the captain began. Suddenly, a violent shudder twisted the ladder, shaking Hatch's hold. One of his feet skidded from the rung, and he grabbed desperately to maintain his purchase. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Bonterre clinging tightly to the array. There was another jolt, then another. Above him, Hatch could hear a distant crumbling sound, like earth collapsing, and a low, barely audible rumble.
"What the hell's happening?" the captain shouted. "Sir!" came Magnuson's voice. "We're picking up ground displacement somewhere in your vicinity."
"Okay, you win. Let's find Wapner and get the hell out." They scrambled up the ladder to the 100-foot platform, the entrance to the vaulted tunnel opening above them, a yawning mouth of rotting wood and earth. Needleman peered inside, lancing his beam into the dampness.
"Wapner! Get a move on! We're aborting the mission!"
As Hatch listened, only silence and a faint, chill wind emanated from the tunnel. Needleman continued looking into the tunnel for a moment. Then he glanced first at Bonterre, then at Hatch, his eyes narrowing. Suddenly, as if galvanized by the same thought, all three unfastened their carabiners and scrambled toward the mouth of the shaft, stepping inside and running down the tunnel. Hatch didn't remember the low passage being this dark somehow, or this claustrophobic. The very air felt different. Then the tunnel opened into a small stone chamber. The two piezoelectric sensors lay on opposite walls of the chamber. Beside one was Wapner's palm-top computer, its RF antenna bent at a crazy angle. Tendrils of mist drifted in the chamber, lanced by their headlamps.
"Wapner," Needleman called, swinging his light around.
"Where the hell did he go?"
Hatch stepped past Needleman and saw something that sent a chill through his vitals. One of the massive groined stones of the ceiling had swung down against the chamber wall. Hatch could see a gap in the ceiling, like a missing tooth, from which damp brown earth dribbled. At floor level, where the base of the fallen ceiling stone pressed against the wall, he could make out something black and white. Moving closer, Hatch realized that it was the canvas and rubber toe of Wapner's sneaker, peeping out between the slabs. In a moment he was beside it, shining his light between the two faces of stone.
"Oh my God," Needleman said behind him.
Hatch could see Wapner, pressed tightly between the two granite faces, one arm pinned to his side, the other canted upward at a crazy angle. His helmeted head was turned to the side, gazing out at Hatch. His eyes were wide and full of tears. Wapner's mouth worked silently as Hatch stared.
"Please."
"Carrie, try to stay calm," Hatch said, running his beam of light up and down the narrow crack while fumbling with his intercom.
"My God, it's amazing he's still alive."
"Streeter," he called into the intercom. "We have a man trapped between two slabs of rock. Get some hydraulic jacks down here. I want oxygen, blood, and saline."
He turned back to Wapner. "Carrie, we're going to jack these slabs apart and get you out very, very soon. Right now, I need to know where you hurt." Again the mouth worked.
"I don't know."
The response came as a high-pitched exhalation.
"I feel all broken up inside."
The voice was oddly slurred, and Hatch realized that the programmer was barely able to move his jaw to speak. Hatch stepped away from the wall face and tore open his medical kit, pulling out a hypo and sucking up 2 cc's of morphine. He wormed his hand between the rough slabs of stone and sank the needle into Wapner's shoulder. There was no flinching, no reaction, nothing. "How is he?" Needleman said, hovering behind him, the air clouding from his breath.
"Get back, for Christ's sakes," Hatch said. "He needs air."
Now he found himself panting, drawing more and more air into his own lungs, feeling increasingly short of breath.
"Be careful," Bonterre said from behind him. "There may be more than one trap."
A trap. It had not occurred to Hatch that this was a trap. But then how else could that huge ceiling stone swing down so neatly?
He tried to reach Wapner's hand to take his pulse, but it was bent too far out of reach.
"Jax, oxygen and plasma on their way," came Streeter's voice over the intercom.
"Good. Have a collapsible stretcher lowered to the 100-foot platform, with inflatable splints and a cervical collar."
"Water,"
Wapner breathed.
Bonterre stepped up and handed Hatch a canteen. He reached into the crack, angling a thin stream of water from the canteen down the side of Wapner's helmet. As the tongue fluttered out to catch the water, Hatch could see that it was blue-black, droplets of blood glistening along its length.
"Jesus, where the hell are those Jacks?"
"Help me, please,"
Wapner rattled and coughed quietly. A few flecks of blood appeared on his chin.
"Punctured lung," thought Hatch.
"Hold on, Kerry, just a couple of minutes," he said as soothingly as he could, and then turned away and stabbed savagely at his intercom.
"Streeter,"
he hissed.
"The Jacks, goddammit, where are the Jacks?"
He felt a wave of dizziness and gulped more air.
"Air quality is moving into the red zone," Needleman said quietly.
"Lowering now," said Streeter amid a burst of static. Hatch turned to Needleman and saw he had already gone to retrieve them.
"Can you feel your arms and legs?" he asked Wapner.
"I don't know."
There was a pause while the programmer gasped for breath.
"I can feel one leg. It feels like the bone has come out."
Hatch angled his light down but was unable to see anything but a twist of trouser in the narrow space, the denim soddened to a dark crimson color.
"Kerry, I'm looking at your left hand. Try to move your fingers."
The hand, strangely bluish and plump-looking, remained motionless for a long moment. Then the index and middle fingers twitched slightly. Relief coursed through Hatch.
"CNS function is still there. If we can get this rock off him in the next few minutes, we've got a chance."
He shook his head, trying to clear it. There was another tremor underfoot and a rain of dirt, and Wapner squealed, a high-pitched, inhuman sound.
"Mon Dieu, what was that?"
Bonterre said, quickly glancing up at the ceiling.
"I think you'd better leave," said Hatch quietly.
"Absolutely not."
"Kerry?"
Hatch peered anxiously into the crack once again. "Kerry, can you answer me?" Wapner stared out at him, a low, hoarse moan escaping his lips. His breath was now wheezing and gurgling. Outside the tunnel, Hatch could hear the thud and clatter of machinery as Needleman pulled in the cable that had been dropped from the surface. He sucked air desperately as a strange buzzing began sounding faintly in his head.
"Can't breathe,"
Wapner managed to say, his eyes pale and glassy. "Kerry,
you're doing great.
Just hold on."
Kerry gasped and coughed again. A trickle of blood ran down from his lips to dangle from his chin. The sound of running footsteps, then Needleman reappeared. He slung two hydraulic jacks to the ground, followed by a portable oxygen cylinder. Hatch grabbed the mask and began screwing the nozzle onto the regulator. Then he spun the dial on the top of the cylinder and heard the reassuring hiss of oxygen. Needleman and Bonterre worked feverishly behind him, tearing off the plastic coverings, unfastening the jacks from the rods, screwing the pieces together. There was another shudder, and Hatch could feel the tall shaft of rock shift under his hand, inching inexorably toward the wall.
"Hurry!"
he cried, head swimming. Dialing the flow to maximum, he snaked the oxygen mask into the narrow gap between the rocks.
"Kerry," he said, "I'm going to place this mask over your face."
He gasped, trying to find the air to keep talking.
"I want you to take slow, shallow breaths, okay? In just a few seconds, we're going to jack this rock off you."
He placed the oxygen mask over Kerry's face, trying to slip it beneath the programmer's misshapen helmet. He had to mold the mask with his fingers to make it narrow enough to fit around the programmer's mashed nose and mouth. Only now did he realize just how tightly the young man was wedged. The moist, panicked eyes looked at him imploringly. Needleman and Bonterre said nothing, working with intense concentration, fitting the pieces of jack together. Craning to get a glimpse into the thinning space, Hatch could see Wapner's face, narrowed alarmingly, his jaw locked open by the pressure. Blood flowed from his cheeks where the edge of the helmet cut into his flesh. He could no longer speak or even scream. His left hand twitched spasmodically, caressing the rock face with purple fingertips. A slight sound of escaping air came from his mouth and nostrils. Hatch knew that the pressure of the rock made breathing almost impossible. "Here it is," Needleman hissed, handing the jack to Hatch. Hatch tried to jam it in the narrowing crack.
"It's too wide,"
he gasped, tossing it back.
"Crank it down."
He turned back to Wapner.
"Now, Carey, I want you to breathe along with me. I'll count them with you, okay?"